This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of local news, and joining us this afternoon, our local politics reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Jason Williams, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. Later in the show, we'll be discussing the news from around Ohio. You can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Jason and Jay, good to see you this afternoon. I haven't seen either of you since last year, so happy new year.
Happy new year to you. Good
happy
to
new
see
year.
You.
And an interesting year it's shaping up to be already.
We don't take any breaks.
That's crazy.
No, and let's start by talking about the Cincinnati mayor's race. Now we've got three candidates.
Three candidates. Rob Richardson Jr. announced his candidacy on Tuesday.
Tuesday, yeah.
And ordinarily, I'd say that might be the highlight of the week, but I think the highlight of the week was the fact that the next day, Charlie Winburn apparently pulls petitions that he may also want to get into the mayor's race.
Well, so we could have four people running.
Could.
Yeah.
I'm sure no one. The only person that knows what Charlie Winburn is going to do is Charlie Winburn.
Absolutely.
And you don't try to second guess him. And he's going to do what's best for Charlie Winburn.
So as far as pulling petitions, what's that expression mean, Jake?
Basically, he's pulled petitions that he is interested in running for the office. I think they have to have 500 signatures.
Yeah.
So he would need to collect 500 signatures. As Howard Wilkinson accurately pointed out, Charlie has probably a closet full of former petitions that he's pulled and never filed. So, and that could very well be what he's up to here, that he's pulled petitions and, you know, is maybe stirring and they likely will not get filed, which he has to file by, I think it's February the 16th.
Yes.
So would he be a Republican or how would he run?
I'm assuming he would run as a Republican.
Yeah, okay. Might be the only Republican candidate on the ticket.
Yeah, I would think so. I don't see anybody else emerging from the GOP.
And I think a lot of Republican money has already been invested in the current mayor, John Cranley. Mm-hmm. So I think that it wouldn't if Charlie gets in, obviously he would be a Republican, but I would think that otherwise the GOP is going to sit on the sidelines for the mayor's race.
Mm-hmm. So if you've got four candidates, you have to have what, a primary?
Fact that there's three candidates.
Yeah. There's three, yeah.
And actually, Howard and I were talking about that in the newsroom this morning. This actually will be the first good primary since 2005.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been 12 years because in 2009, when Mark Mallory was running for re-election, there wasn't a primary. And 2013, the top names were John Cranley and Roxanne Qualls, and then two perennial candidates who we won't name. But this time, there's actually three pretty viable candidates in the primary.
And it's back because there was a charter amendment. Is now the city primary is now in May instead of September like it has been in the past. So they moved it up.
And the top two vote getters then will go on to
run against each other in November. Yeah.
Correct.
Jay, can you give us a little background about Rob Richardson?
I really don't know that. I know he is coming off of a term as chairman of the UC Board of Trustees and tied into the labor community.
Yeah, I've
he's
been
a labor attorney, right?
He is, yeah.
Okay.
And I've spent quite a bit of time this year, or 2016, getting to know him. And I've really enjoyed getting to know him. And he spent 9 years. That's a 9-year commitment to be on the UC board. So he was on the UC board essentially for the last decade. His term just ended at the end of 2016. I give him credit for really staying the course because he was the chairman all of last year at UC. I give him credit. There was a lot going on there. New president, football coach, trying to do police reform out of the Tenzing thing. And, you know, he really focused on that and waited to make his mayoral announcement this past Tuesday. I give him credit for that, you know, he didn't allow that to distract his work at UC, which is a very important job as, you know, a $1 billion institution and
role. You had a column on this. Is it in today's paper? Or is it on Sunday? It's online.
Just online. Yeah.
I saw it online today. How Rob Richardson and Yvette Simpson are going to campaign against each other?
Yeah, there a lot of. I spent the week after he, and a little bit even before he announced on Tuesday, just kind of talking to some people behind the scenes on what they thought about this, and so I gathered a handful of bullet points, essentially, of people saying what he really should do, and that's, focus mainly on trying to take out Yvette Simpson. It's really, really hard. It's a long shot to take out an incumbent mayor, especially Cranley, who's got a record of accomplishments.
He's a good fundraiser, too.
For oh, yeah. And a lot of cash, record accomplishments, politically savvy. So that was kind of the overriding message, was if he would focus on Yvette, he's still the underdog, that might give him at least a chance of getting through the primary. And he's a first-time candidate. This is his first time to ever run for office, and he's going big right out of the gate.
How's he positioning himself, Jason?
He's positioned himself as the outsider. If on the surface, he is the outsider. He's the only one who's not at City Hall right now, so he can play that card and continue to repeat that message. In reality, he's really not an outsider. He's been very involved in politics locally, behind the scenes, worked a lot on the streetcar referendums. He's a pro streetcar person. His dad is a very well respected leader in the community, NAACP. President locally, and a nationally known leader in the labor movement, and so that helped him get his appointment at UC. And so outsiders really don't get that appointment. That's got to be a political connection there. So, but certainly he can say I'm an outsider because he's not in City Hall right now, and the other two candidates are.
Yeah, has he pointed to what goes on at City Hall? How there always seems to be infighting or squabbling going on as one of the problems he sees.
Yeah, he really pointed that out a lot in his message the other night, and a tremendous turnout at his launch on Tuesday night up in Coryville. I projected around 200 people, and it was an energetic room and a great mix of young folks and old folks and black folks and white folks and Asian, and it was really cool to see like this energetic, diverse crowd that came out for him. And he really hammered the outsider thing. He really talked a lot about, I want to end the political squabbles, and he didn't mention him by name, but the mayor's always positioning himself for the next political maneuver, and so he touched on that as well.
You think that's a tough campaign promise to make, Jay, ending political squabbles?
I was just thinking that Mayor Mallory ran in 2005 to end the chaos, and some 12 years later, I don't know that there's any less chaos at Cincinnati City Hall.
Well, that's city politics. I mean, like probably most, you go to most cities and that's just City Hall.
It sounds good, but it's just, in some ways, City Hall is a little bit of chaos, and it always will be.
How much does he plan to incorporate his experience at UC into his campaign?
He very much indicated that is going to be a big message that he shares. And he spent 9 years there. It's again, a $1 billion institution and the second largest employer in the region, and that's a big responsibility to be the chairperson of the University of Cincinnati. So I think he can, if he positions that right, he can talk about a lot of the things he's done there and show people that, hey, I've been in a very prominent leadership role before. Now, I don't think most people know really who the chairman of UC is or the chairperson or even really who's on the board. Usually it's who the president is. I don't even really know if you knew who the president was that much until Nancy Zimfer fired Bob Huggins, and then Santa Ono comes along as a tweet master, and so he really brought a face to the franchise. But a lot of time, I don't think the general public knows who's in charge at UC.
I did think it was interesting, too. I think he mentioned that this mayor's race was about more than the streetcar, and he may say that, but I still think that's going to be an undercurrent.
I do, too.
For supporters who want to take the streetcar uptown, if Mayor Cranley is reelected in November, one would assume that any talk of taking the streetcar uptown is a non-issue for the next 4 years.
Yeah. I think right now Cranley's in the driver's seat in terms of the streetcar. The ridership numbers are obviously, it's still early, and I know people have pointed this out to me, and there's not a good trend there with the ridership numbers, and just your unscientific look at the thing, and it's when it's rolling around the streets in the middle of the day, it's empty or just a couple people. And there's no joy in that, seeing that happen. You know, you want it to succeed. But right now, in terms of where that thing is at and where it seems like it's trending in terms of ridership and revenue, I believe Cranley's got a nice card to play there in this race against two very pro street car candidates.
Well, I think in Rob Richardson's case, what he's saying is that the street car itself is too narrow of mm-hmm. an issue. He's talking about looking at transportation in the area as a whole, right?
Yeah, he did touch on that, and actually, Yvette Simpson has mentioned that as well. It's a part of a greater, grander regional transportation system. Is that, you know, if you take it to Uptown, you connect the two job centers on the streetcar, and then maybe, you know, you get it there, and years later you start taking it out to, I don't know, Hyde Park or up to Avondale, or, you know, keep going. Or you can maybe connect some bus routes into it and make it this regional type of multimodal is sort of the buzzword transportation system. I give him credit for at least putting that out there in terms of mentioning it. It is certainly our public transportation system needs to be addressed. It's our bus system right now is need some help.
What about support from labor, from the unions? You had John Cranley picking up support from several of the major unions in the city. And then, of course, Richardson himself, he's a labor attorney. Mm-hmm. So are they going to split the labor vote, or what do you think?
Rob Richardson's father is vice president of a local laborers union. And this is a union that has a lot of money. And he has the cachet, I think is what I wrote, to go out beyond Cincinnati and help bring in support from the outside. And the thing about the laborers is that, unlike a lot of other unions, that there's a lot of other unions that have kind of a more of a formal process and they don't get too immersed in it. But the laborers can be a little more unpredictable, and they don't really have this real set process in terms of how they get involved in politics. And so what I've been told is, like, and you see it in campaign fund, like, they will go all out and pour in a lot of money and ground game. And so that certainly that plays into Rob Richardson Jr.'s favor. On the flip side, Cranley last year made, you know, it was politically, it was strokes of genius when he proposed the raises for several unions. It was about 6,000 employees, the police, firefighters, sanitation workers. And so he really won a lot of favor with the unions. And so that's what we saw this week when he called a press conference. Some of that, I think he was just trying to chomping at the bit to wait for this day that Richardson, who's, you know, pro-union, to announce he was going to run. And then Cranley was ready to pounce, and he was waiting for this day.
And I think there was, what, did he announce two unions that day?
Yeah.
And something tells me that down the road we're going to have these rollout press conferences.
Yep.
Where there will be perhaps police and fire will do theirs at another press conference, and then the other city labor unions too, because they all benefited from the pay raises.
Absolutely.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us this afternoon for our review of local news, local politics reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Jason Williams, and WVXU City Hall reporter, Jay Hanselman. You can join us with your questions and comments, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Jay, three definite people running for mayor right now, possibility of Charlie Winburn joining in. What do you think his strategy might be?
From what I'm told from a couple of wise sources at City Hall, his strategy seems to be that he thinks that if he gets in, there would then be three African-Americans in the race, four candidates total, three of them African-American. that, with three African-American candidates in the race, kind of divides up the black vote. And then Mr. Winburn, being Republican, could pull some Republican votes away from John Cranley. And Mr. Winburn sees a possibility that perhaps he could, with that dynamic of three African-Americans and him pulling Republican votes, that somehow he could get John Cranley to finish in third or fourth place. That's probably a long shot, but that seems to be the strategy that I've heard. And I'm sure that, as Jason and I were talking off the air, Charlie Winburn polls everything. So I can't believe that he's not polling and would know, you know, what his chances are.
Yeah, he does poll everything. So the Inquirer yesterday broke the story about so Winburn, as Jay pointed out earlier, that he's just a wild card. You don't know what he's going to do. Right now, I mean, I'll point out in his long career that he's never won a head-to-head race. You know, the field race is different, the council. Last 2 years, he's really gotten hammered in a state Senate race against Cecil Thomas and then in a primary race for recorder this past year against Norbert Nadel. So you have that. He has that working against him. He also, yesterday, the Inquirer broke the story about the FBI coming in to take boxes out of his office after a person in his office was seen, or I don't know if seen, but some was going to take these boxes out of City Hall.
Basically, from what I was told, had moved them from the office to the basement.
Yeah, to a basement, and then to have them taken out of City Hall. And there was a staffer at City Hall that pointed out and said, hey, that you can't do that. And so that started all this. And so the FBI came in and took these boxes, and that's where what we know right now.
And I think that in itself is a bizarre situation where you have a staffer moving boxes to the basement. And someone at City Hall, it rose to the level that someone thought that they needed to tell the city solicitor that these boxes
were... Yeah, somebody actually noticed this going on and said something.
Somebody noticed it going on, thought that the city solicitor needed to be aware of it. The solicitor thought it was important enough to call the police department. The police department thought it was important enough to call the FBI, and the FBI came to collect the boxes. And
but this is all we know at this point.
That's all we.
Now Winburn says that it's just full of old news, inquirers and business couriers
and desk clutter.
And desk clutter, yes.
Whatever, we're not sure what that means, but he did call it desk clutter.
So in fairness to him, that's what he said are in the boxes.
And
what's the implication, Jay? He's trying to bury something where...
We assume that in some way it is connected, and even though this has never been confirmed by the FBI, that they are investigating contracting and spending practices in the Metropolitan Sewer District, and a couple of those people that could be investigated as part of that are pretty close to Mr. Winburn. As far as I know, the only reporting on that has been from the Inquirer.
Yeah.
That someone told them that the FBI was investigating. The FBI has never confirmed that they're officially doing a review of MSD.
So this could be an obstacle if he does decide to run.
Yeah, absolutely. And our reporters, Sharon Coolidge and Dan Horn, have done a tremendous job looking into the MSD, and I'll point out, like, I don't know if there's any connection here between what happened with the boxes taken out in MSD. So, but in fairness, I don't know if there's a connection there.
I mean, that would be the only thing that I think you could assume.
Sure.
And of course, you know, we were joking about that he's had petitions in the past. There could be old petitions that he never filed in those boxes.
That could be all what's in the boxes. When was the last time we had a Republican mayor in Cincinnati? It's been, was it Ken Blackwell? Was that the last one?
I looked this up last summer.
That sounds about right. And see, even that, though, that was the top, I'm assuming, the top vote getter. There's never been a Republican, quote, stronger mayor since the charter was redone in 99, and Charlie Lucan was first elected as a stronger mayor in 2001.
And the Republicans haven't run anyone for mayor since 09, when Brad Winstrup ran against Mallory
we were looking this morning. I thought that was a fluke, but if you look at that, there were only 6,000 votes between them,
Which is a very sizable margin. Yeah.
So let's change to a different topic here. Jay, City Manager Harry Black this week, he's now saying that any legal settlement reached by the city that's over $5,000
is it?
That's over $5,000 is going to have to be disclosed to City Council. So what?
Well, what this goes
prompted
back,
all this.
This goes back to the settlement that came to light last week, where the police chief was terminated. Former police chief Jeffrey Blackwell was terminated by the city manager in September of 2015, and he threatened a lawsuit. And there was a lot of behind the scenes negotiations, and they reached a settlement agreement in August of this year, and it was kept quiet until the week between Christmas and New Year's, which. If you go back to Mr. Winburn's boxes ending up in the basement, you know, that was in a matter of 24 hours that someone knew that those boxes had been moved from the upstairs to the downstairs.
But they didn't know this settlement.
But they didn't. And that really surprises me that they kept a secret like that that long at City Hall, because normally things there aren't secret. And it still is amazing to me that it took 4 months for that to come to light. But anyway, there were some council members who were caught blindsided that they didn't know about this settlement. There's a couple of motions filed that they had to be notified, and those still could be voted on. But essentially, the manager said on a monthly basis, any settlement of more than $5,000, they'll be notified about.
But it's not like they haven't had access to this information.
No, we were playing around on the city as part of the state treasurer's OhioCheckbook.com, and if you type in Jeffrey Blackwell's name, there's clearly a payment that was made to him that you could see that was like $190,000. So, I mean, it wasn't – if you wanted to find it, you could find it, but I'm not sure council members or anybody else for that matter would have a reason to go look for it.
Howard Wilkinson is now correcting us for something. He says that Ken Blackwell actually ran as a charterite for mayor. So it was Eugene Ruhlman.
Okay.
According to Howard, who was the last Republican.
Well, we will not question Howard's...
Howard's knowledge of the history of politics. You don't question that. But Gene Ruhlman, last Republican, 1971. It's been that long.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem like it's too likely that we're going to get a Republican mayor yet.
Before we pass up on the... There is one thing, though, about the settlement and the whole hubbub with Jeffrey Blackwell. I thought it was interesting. Clearly, Councilmember Simpson... Councilmember Young and Councilmember Seelbach, I think they thought this was going to be a campaign issue that they could hang on John Cranley.
Yeah,
and they wanted to hire an independent outside investigator to look at this issue, and council basically filed or killed that idea this week by a 5-3 vote. I'm just curious.
So they're not going to pursue this any further, or
at least
no,
right
I, now. Actually, I mean. P.G. Sittenfeld was really sort of the deciding vote here, who he at times, you know, he'll vote with one coalition or the other. You know, there's a lot of times he will vote with Yvette Simpson and Seelbach.
But from the political angle, I guess what I can't figure out, why not just make it a political issue and not worry? I mean, just say, if that's your issue, John Cranley fired the police chief.
I think they're going to continue with that.
But I don't think you – I guess my point is I don't know that you needed an investigation to prove that or to say that.
I mean, it was worth a try at least, I mean, in terms of politically. And if – you know, certainly Yvette Simpson is a very stickler for the charter. And, you know, she was real – I know politics are very tied up in this, but I genuinely believe like she is concerned about the charter being violated, that the mayor, who is not allowed to just go and make a personnel decision on a police chief, it has to be up to the city manager. So I believe that there was – you know, again, politics are still there, but I believe there was some genuine like, let's get to the bottom of this.
I guess the thing that I stumble with is that – to prove that, they would almost have to assume that John Cranley brought the police chief into his office and said, "You're fired," and the guy across the hall, Harry Black, knew absolutely nothing about it.
Yeah,
and clearly, I don't think that, even by Black's own admission, that did not happen.
So back to the mayor's race for a second. How interesting is this going to get?
We're in the first week of 17 here, and you know, this has already been pretty wild. Well, I mean, even go back to the last few weeks of last year with the Blackwell.
I mean, you even take yesterday at the council meeting, Yvette Simpson had three ordinances to ceremonially rename three streets around the former King Records location, and the mayor held those. And it's like, I mean, if you're holding up ceremonial street renamings,
yeah. I mean, come on,
it's politics, and it's silly season, and it's going to be that way until May the 2nd.
Funny thing is that then an hour later, they went over to the county building for Denise Driehaus's swearing in as commissioner. The only seat available when Yvette walked in was right next to John Cranley, and some people sent me some photos, and it was it looked very, very uncomfortable.
Very interesting. Jason and Jay, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Local politics reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Jason Williams, and WVXU City Hall reporter, Jay Hanselman. Coming up, we'll take a look at what's going on at the State House and around Ohio. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of news affecting the tri-state. Joining us now, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Issues reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Lisa, Karen, and Howard, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hey.
Thank you.
Lisa, let's start by talking about, because I find this just fascinating, Ohio's medical marijuana law. It actually took effect back in September. Here we are. It's several months later, we're into 2017, and they're still working on the rules for this thing, aren't they?
That's right. So when it was legalized, technically, in September, built into the law was a two-year rulemaking plan that's really created or meant to create this framework for how the law is going to be implemented and enforced. And so this year, 2017, is when the brunt of that rulemaking is going to be taking place. And just to give you an idea of how this is going to work, you know, there's three state agencies that are going to be charged with drafting some rules. The Ohio Department of Commerce has some authority over creating the rules for licensing and the compliance of cultivators and processors. The medical board is going to oversee certifying physicians. The Ohio Pharmacy Board will oversee the creation of a patient registration form, so to speak. And so all of these rules will be proposed this year, and those recommendations will go to this 14-member advisory board that's hosting monthly meetings and hearings to go over these draft rules.
So 2017 is going to be a really busy year for these 14 people, it sounds like, and for anybody else who's creating the policy surrounding this.
Absolutely. And already they've been to work. There's some draft rules that have been proposed. They're open for public comment, I think, through January 13th. Rules for how medical marijuana dispensaries would be licensed have been proposed. One of the sort of standout features of that is in the first two years of the program, there would be just 40 medical marijuana licenses available. And we've heard from some medical marijuana advocates that they think that's far too few. Built into that proposal is a call on the advisory board to review whether that 40 license threshold is too few or too many every 2 years, but already we're hearing some rumblings from folks who are saying they're not happy, at least with that piece.
Well, what I've heard, Lisa, is that the 40 dispensaries would mean that you'd have like what, close to something like 4,700 patients per dispensary?
Exactly. You know, folks that are watching this are looking at what's happened in other states. And they're looking at the projections of the number of patients that would likely be available or able to use medical marijuana under the program rules. And they say, "What you're just right, you know, 47 patients per dispensary, and that's far too many."
So we have legalized medical marijuana in the state, but we don't have many of the rules in place. We don't have the dispensaries in place so far. So how does that work for the patients? If you've got a doctor's authorization, I mean, do you have to wait till the entire infrastructure is in place before you can use medical marijuana?
You know, there are experts out there that say that would be the wisest thing to do. Again, built into the rule is an affirmative defense that essentially says if you were prosecuted, you know, if you were taken to court, you could use affirmative defense, but you're still facing court costs, all of that. defend yourself. But what we're hearing from folks that, again, have watched this in other states are saying, just wait until the rules go into place. That's probably your safest bet.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that they have until the end of 2018 to get everything in place. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. So the timeline for this, again, as the rules are proposed, reworked, and tweaked throughout 2017, they have all the way until September of 2018 to get this program up and running.
And that's a long time for some of these people who, are really need this.
It is. It's the other side of that is folks are saying it's going to take a long time to get this infrastructure up and running. And just from the perspective of, putting a business plan together that has some, staying power and pulling the capital together that it's going to take, because again, this is an all cash business. You can't go out and get a loan from a bank to open a medical marijuana dispensary, because federally this is still an illegal drug and banks don't lend to medical or other marijuana related businesses. So it's not an easy business to get up and running.
So, Lisa, as an issues reporter, I guess you're going to be keeping a close eye on what's going on with this. I mean, there's a lot yet to come.
There definitely is. It's going to be interesting to see what kind of feedback we're going to continue to see as the rules are proposed, and it's going to be an interesting year.
And Karen, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I just wanted to add in that, you do have some critics who say that this was by design, that lawmakers didn't really want this to happen and have deliberately dragged their feet. But it really does speak to how difficult it is to get something going. And you know, even when you are trying to make rules for things that are legal under federal law, it can be very time consuming. It takes a lot of time to get a lot of different agencies involved. So, you have some folks who are saying, hey, this passed in September or became law in September, why can't we have access now? Well, it takes a long, long time. And I do have to wonder, too, the nominee for Attorney General of the United States, Jeff Sessions, has said that he has looked at states and would be looking at states that legalized marijuana. And I just wonder what the future of the Ohio legalization of medical marijuana might be. I mean, we only legalized medical marijuana, not recreational marijuana. That could make a difference, but it's still interesting to note.
And Karen, you're saying that some are saying it's deliberate by design, because there were efforts to either put this into law or to make it part of Ohio's constitution, right?
Right. There have been two. Well, there was one that actually went to the ballot that would have legalized recreational and medical marijuana. That created that so-called monopoly that a lot of people were concerned about in 2014. That one failed. And then there was another one that was that was 2015. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm getting my ears mixed up.
The ears got by quickly, don't they?
they do tend to run together, yes.
Right. But then there was also an effort that was started this year by a group that really wanted to do medical marijuana, and then lawmakers came back at the beginning of 2015, or 2016 rather, and said, we want to do this. Then the group that was trying to go to the ballot dropped their effort. But they've said that they would bring it back if they feel like the rules were being drawn so tightly that people couldn't get access. So it's certainly something to watch.
Karen, you also had an interesting story on the Statehouse website about Ohio's only Democrat who's serving in statewide office, and that would be Ohio Supreme Court Justice William O'Neill. He's using this year to deliberate whether he wants to run for governor or not.
Well, can I just drop in something really quickly here? I want to make sure that people are aware of what's going on the other side of the aisle right now, the Ohio Republican Party. There was a vote today for chairman of the Ohio Republican Party, Matt Borges, who had been the chairman since 2012. He was fighting to keep his job. He had some pretty well-publicized concerns about Donald Trump, ended up endorsing him. But in the end, there were two votes that went nowhere because you had to get 34 of the 66 members of the state central committee to vote for you. He had a challenger in Jane Timpkin from Stark County, the Canton area, and she was a big Trump supporter. And finally, after two rounds of voting that went nowhere, the two went behind closed doors and agreed on a deal. She is the new Ohio Republican Party chair, and Matt Borges is the chairman emeritus. And we're still trying to figure out exactly
what
that means.
We don't know what that means.
And it's not in the in the bylaws of the state party, chairman emeritus. I mean, he's out. I mean, but this thing is so extraordinary.
Well, it's interesting because you have an extension of the Trump-Kasich dispute.
Well,
Kasich backing Borges and then Trump backing Timken. Yeah.
He has come into the state and he has unseated a state party chair who has been extremely successful getting Republicans elected to statewide office, every statewide office.
And you just do have to look back to right after 2010 when Republicans had that huge tsunami of Republicans that brought Kasich and all these other Republicans into statewide office under Kevin DeWine, who was the party chair at that time. And Kasich kind of helped install Matt Borges over Kevin DeWine as the party chair. Well, now the same kind of thing had happened to Matt Borges. He had a lot of success in the last couple of years, but his concerns about Trump were significant enough to some people in the party that Jane Timken launched her candidacy and challenged to him. And in the end, she is now the first woman to chair the Ohio Republican Party. And it will be very interesting to see how these two roles mesh or if they do,
As you mentioned, you needed 34 votes to get this. Well, there weren't 34 votes. There were 33 votes.
Because, we got 33, 32 twice, didn't you?
Okay. Because a woman from Muskingum County had the flu and didn't get there.
Right.
And, you know, and nobody's quite sure how she would have voted. I don't know.
I don't know either. But one thing that was interesting here is, and it was widely reported, that Donald Trump himself, President-elect of the United States, was making phone calls last night to State Central Committee members to suggest that Jane Timken would be the person that they should vote for, which is really pretty amazing when you think about it.
Did I hear you correctly? Well, he was making phone calls, not tweeting?
He was tweeting too.
Was he doing both?
Yeah,
he
was actually making phone calls.
Yeah, and he was sending letters, faxing stuff. I mean, he was doing, he was doing his own personal lobbying.
Which is really,
he was really actively campaigning for that.
Yes.
So,
this was one of his grudge matches. Yeah.
Exactly. The way that Howard just described it. The tensions between the Trump campaign and Matt Borges were well known. I mean, there was a point at which sometime this fall where the Trump campaign in Ohio had announced a split with Matt Borges. And, Borges had claimed all along that he had concerns, but that he talked to Donald Trump a lot. I mean, going back to the Republican convention in Cleveland, that he talked to Trump a lot, that some people had even called him the Trump whisperer at one point. And what's really amazing, too, is there were stories back last summer that, when we didn't know what was going to happen at the convention, that perhaps Matt Borges could become the chair of the Republican National Committee.
Right.
And now here we are. He's in a position where his job is very undefined. And, people are wondering if he's really going to have much of a role there, though he has told our Joe Ingles, who is there right now, that he will be advising Jane Timken and he's not going anywhere. So it's an extraordinary set of events.
Karen, I mean, you and I were both in Cleveland, and and you remember, I'm sure, the tension that was in that delegation because of all the basically grief they were getting from the Trump campaign not because of Matt Borges in particular, but because of John Kasich and the way he was behaving, not going anywhere near Quicken Loans Arena, the site of the convention. He wouldn't go in. He wouldn't endorse him. He wouldn't even mention his name.
Right. And in the end, of course, when this was, I think, what a lot of it was about, was in the end, when it became clear that Donald Trump was the party nominee, there were people who were very concerned about him, who didn't want to stand up and applaud him at the convention, who came over to the Trump team.
That's right.
And there was a concern that Matt Borges was not fully behind him, that he didn't offer what was called unwavering support. Those two words coming from a letter that some county chairs had sent out to members of the State Central Committee about Jane Timken, saying that the party needs somebody who can offer unwavering support.
Well, and that was Timken's point. She said he had a duty to support Trump.
Right.
If I remember
and
right.
There were plenty of people who felt that that's the role of a party chair, is to set aside whatever your concerns are and make sure that the person who's the nominee selected through the primary process is indeed the person that you're backing. And so...
Did I hear right, Karen, that Governor Kasich is going to attend the inauguration?
Yeah. Yes, that's what he has told reporters.
That's what he says now.
Yeah.
And now, you have to remember, this is in the context of the fact that Donald Trump won Ohio by a substantial margin.
And I just wonder, too, his timing of that was right before this vote, a couple of days before this vote.
Yeah.
And, I wonder if you know, there's a lot of timing issues here. I mean, as this vote was going on, the votes were going to Capitol Hill for the Electoral College votes.
Sure.
And, obviously Donald Trump won Ohio. So the timing of this was really interesting, I thought, when you would watch, like a feed from Capitol Hill, seeing those votes coming in as you might be watching maybe what was happening here in Columbus on the Ohio Republican Party chair.
And Karen, going back to what I had mentioned earlier, Governor Kasich.
I avoided your question.
Yeah,
I'm
Governor Kasich. Well, that's okay. You brought up a good point. We were going to discuss this anyhow. I'm glad you brought it up. But Governor Kasich, he can't run again. He's term limited. He's done. You've got people lining up to run for governor next year. The only Democrat who's serving in the in statewide office, which is Supreme Court Justice William O'Neill, is saying he's thinking about it. He might throw his hat in the ring.
He's a really interesting person.
He is.
He's a U.S. veteran. He's a lawyer, obviously. He's a registered nurse.
Yeah. And outspoken.
Very outspoken. His dissents are worth reading if you're into that sort of thing. But I talked to him earlier this week, and he said that, yes, indeed, he was considering. He can't announce that he's running, because if he did, he'd have to leave the Supreme Court bench. So for the next year, he said he's going to, get some feedback, some input from people. But he says he's very concerned about the Ohio Democratic Party. He would run as a Democrat. He is a Democrat, he says. But he's been pretty critical of the Ohio Democratic Party.
I think the quote that you had is he wants to see if the Ohio Democratic Party has learned anything from 2016.
Yes. Yeah. Right. He was very there was a widely publicized Facebook post that he put out when the Ohio Democratic Party endorsed Ted Strickland before the primary with P.G. Sittenfeld, the Cincinnati City Councilman, and O'Neill blasted the party for doing that and saying that the inmates were running the asylum and that Ted Strickland was a walking dead man and that it would doom his campaign. He turned out to be correct in that Ted Strickland did lose pretty substantially.
Right.
I think Bill O'Neill would like to see a primary, but he has made it really clear that if Richard Cordray, the former Ohio Attorney General and the current head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, if he runs, then O'Neill's out.
Yeah, I think that's true.
What do we?
And I don't know. I don't know if Tim Ryan or somebody else, Betty Sutton or somebody else shows up, what Bill O'Neill would do.
Lisa, did you want to get something in?
Yeah, I was going to say it seems like Richard Cordray would be a strong candidate. I'm curious about Howard and Karen, what your thoughts are on sort of the prospects there.
I'll be interested. Tim Ryan is in. I mean, people have talked about him for a long time. I think the idea that he ran against Nancy Pelosi for minority leader of the U.S. House really kind of put his name out there. But he's in a tough district in that it's a Democratic district, but everybody but Mahoning County went for Donald Trump. And so, he would have some work to do to try to win back some of those people potentially. But then again, the Democratic Party, I think, is really trying to figure out exactly what it's going to do in 2018, given, you've got this Bernie Sanders wing, so to speak. You've got the Democrats who voted for Donald Trump in Ohio, who were significant enough for him to have won the state. So you have Joe Schiavone, the Senate Minority Leader, the Ohio Senate Minority Leader, who has said he will run, and he's in the same area as Tim Ryan. So, Connie Pillich from Cincinnati, she's talked about being a candidate. And so I think there are a couple of people who are out there who are potential candidates. But the question is, how do you go up against the three or four Republicans who are fairly well known, who have all said they're interested in running?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think Richard Cordray and Connie Pillich, those are the kind of people who could have that crossover vote that would kind of, you know, might be able to unite the party. But you're right about the Republicans. I mean, you know, you've got Mike DeWine, you've got John Husted, you've got Mary Taylor, and, you know, who knows who else going to jump into a Republican primary. Now, that is going to force them to spend a lot of money and also do a lot of damage to each other. So, you know, whoever wins that primary is going to be pretty beat up by the time they come out.
That's true. And if you'll remember back in 2006, which was 2 years after George Bush won and, you know, became the first Republican in office since, I mean, when Bill Clinton left, then it was George Bush. And so, you know, those midterm elections after a party change at the White House can really make a difference. And so, you know, you had Ken Blackwell, as was mentioned earlier, and Jim Petro both running on the Republican side for governor. And it was very expensive, very costly personally to Jim Petro and Ken Blackwell. Blackwell ended up coming into the campaign that fall pretty beaten up, and Ted Strickland just destroyed him. And so the question, and Ted Strickland was not all that well known going into that race. So, you know, it's been pointed out to me that that could happen, but certainly Democrats have a lot of work to do to try to nail down who their candidate might be and get things moving because this is going to be an expensive race.
Karen, before we wrap up here, a couple of things I wanted to touch on. The Ohio General Assembly got back in session this week. What are their priorities for the year?
I think, well, the first priority is the budget. The budget, the governor's budget comes out at the end of this month, and the governor came to the Ohio House at the during the lame duck session a couple weeks ago saying Ohio is on the verge of a recession. And so, you know, you can debate that a lot, and a lot of people are saying that the economic indicators don't say that we're in a recession, but the income tax collection, the revenues are coming in below projections, which is going to make for a tough budget process. So that's the first priority. But they've also talked about tax reform. They've talked about overturning some of the vetoes that Kasich put out on some of these bills related to green energy standards for electric utilities, abortion, some of these other things. Those bills would have to start all over again, but there are some lawmakers who feel like that they could do that. And, you know, you come into this with 66 members of the Ohio House are Republicans compared to 33 Democrats, 24 members of the Ohio Senate are Republicans compared to 9 Democrats. So the Republicans have a lot of power right now, and the question is whether they're going to use it. And how they're going to use it.
And also we heard from Ohio Senator Rob Portman, who's saying he thinks that there's going to be a vote to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act in Congress. He's predicting it's likely by the end of the month. So,
Howard?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that what you're hearing?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. So what happens in the meantime? I mean, you talk about replacing it. How long is that actually going to take? That's not going to happen immediately, is it?
No, I get the impression it's not going to take going to be immediate. It's going to take months for them to put something together that makes sense.
Might take years from some things I've heard, too.
Oh, yeah.
Take a couple of years.
I mean, there are parts of this that the American people approve of.
And I would also – oh, go ahead.
No, that they approve of and they want to keep. And the Republicans would be foolish to get rid of the entire thing.
And for state policy purposes, I'd add that, you know, Ohio did expand Medicaid under the auspices of the Affordable Care Act. And so if something changes there, there are a lot of people who are now on Medicaid here in Ohio under that expansion who could be affected. So,
and Kasich has warned.
Didn't Governor Kasich credit the expansion of Medicaid with dealing with the opioid epidemic in the state?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's a serious issue. I mean, we've got a serious problem in the state with prescription painkillers and opioids. And that's been something that a lot of people have said Medicaid expansion has helped with.
Well, Lisa, Karen, and Howard, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Issues reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. Pete Reitmeier was the producer for today's show. Belinda Kai was the assistant producer. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Thank you. According to the U.S. State Department, 600,000 to 800,000 people are trafficked across international borders each year. Of those, 80% are female and half are children. On the next Cincinnati edition, we'll discuss local efforts to prevent human trafficking and organizations that provide help to its victims. And in Focus on Technology, using high-definition cameras and a computer algorithm to fight toxic algal blooms. That's Cincinnati edition, Monday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.